The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Sarah Crown.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
I think if I had to, choose one thing that characterised British literature, both prose and poetry, I would say it was geography, and more widely, I would say landscape.
One definition of literature, certainly fiction, I think, is, the idea of characters moving across a landscape of some kind.
Novels teach you about a place. They teach you to feel and see it differently, and they make places larger.
British literature, really, from the earliest year, a lot of the Anglo-Saxon poetry is about the way environment and emotion are related.
What a landscape and what place has sort of embedded within it are all of those shared cultural associations, and as a writer, when you're looking to connect with a reader, your landscape is a fantastic shortcut.
So we're standing in the Packard Gallery at the British Library, watching the final touches being put to the Writing Britain exhibition, which opens at the library today. I'm here with Jamie Andrews and Tanya Kirk, who've both been involved in curating the exhibition. And the space itself is absolutely amazing. We've got pictures of maps hanging from the ceiling and on the floor, beautiful screens of British suburbia, which I presume has perhaps something to do with J.G. Ballard, and many, many exhibition cases filled with writing materials from the authors who have been collected together as examples of what Writing Britain means. Jamie, what I really wanted to ask you is why? Why did you decide that British writing or British landscape writing merited an exhibition like this?
Well, it's a specific time. It's 2012. It's summer 2012. So there's something going on with the Olympics. There's the Cultural Olympiad. There's a sense that cultural institutions in London and the UK are taking the time to look at their collections and look about what their collections are saying about the spaces and places of Britain, which will be highlighted to the world during the Olympics. And so for us, it was a great way of combining the absolute strengths of the library's collections, which are its literary treasures, everything from Chaucer right through to J.G. Ballard, spanning over 1,000 years, every type of manuscript, rare edition, photographs, maps. So it's a way of trawling through that and really bringing out some highlights, and at the same time using those to talk about how we and how writers have seen Britain, both the kind of eternal spaces of Britain, which remain recognisable now as they were when they were first described maybe hundreds of years ago, and also the way that the writers have marked the changing face of Britain and perhaps in a way created the sense of Britain and how we think about the spaces and places of the British Isles.
So talking about material that's spanning 1,000 years, he said, what's the earliest thing that you've got here and what's the most contemporary?
Answering that backwards, the most contemporary is probably something we just picked up about half an hour ago. It's come directly from the house of Hanif Qureshi. It's his draft of The Buddha of Suburbia, which is going in the area looking at the suburbs, looking at spaces beyond the city, and also one of his diaries where he describes going to meet David Bowie, who did the soundtrack for the film. Hanif Qureshi is not the only novelist, the only contemporary writer that we're talking to. We've got material from people like Ian McEwan, Jonathan Coe, J.G. Ballard, Graham Swift. So stuff that's never been seen before, that has been often still with the writers themselves, and they've had to go and rootle around to dig it out. Going backwards, we've got the Exeter book, which has also just arrived this afternoon from Exeter Cathedral, early Anglo-Saxon 10th century manuscript, and we are displaying...
What's that about? Can you tell me about that?
It's a poem called The Seafarer, which is going in our Waterland section, looking at the seas, the coastal spaces of Britain, and the rivers and the lakes. And this is the recollection of an old seafarer who recalls the hardship at sea, but also recalls the kind of metaphorical power of the sea that shaped his life. We've also got early manuscripts of the Canterbury Tales, which opens just outside London in Southwark, just outside the city of London anyway, in Southwark. And of course, the pilgrims tell tall tales of the city, and a number of the stories are set in or around London. And we've got a manuscript of Piers Plowman, written by William Langland, a contemporary of Chaucer, a very early manuscript again, which describes, well, Piers Plowman opens in the Malvern Hills, so it's the idea of the dreamer awaking in the hills, but there's a key part of the narrative which is set in London in Cheapside and describes the hurly-burly and the slightly nefarious goings-on in London at that time.
We're not just talking about the countryside, are we? When we think of landscapes, often, you know, the things that come to mind are things like Emily Bronte and the Yorkshire Moors, that kind of thing. But you're looking at city landscapes as well and suburban landscapes.
Yeah, it's a really good point. When we chewed over the title, we literary landscapes was obviously something we were talking about, but we didn't want to use that as a title precisely, as you say, because landscape can all too often conjure up images of rural spaces or wild places, which are absolutely part of this exhibition, but which don't begin to tell the whole story about the way that writers have engaged with the spaces and places of Britain. And so for that reason, we came up with Writing Britain, which covers all of the spaces that we're including, which do range from those kind of eternal pastoral images of the British countryside through to the kind of slightly more unknowable wild spaces, whether it's the Lake District or the Highlands in Scotland, but also absolutely those kind of urban landscapes. Most of the British population live in cities, and writers have absolutely engaged with cities since the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution.
Where was I born after I was born? Well, I was truly born in Whitechapel Library. You know, therefore, it's like a rebirth, and it's like hard to talk about rebirth, you know. It didn't change anything, it just gave me a great well of joy. And the reference library, where my thoughts were to rage, I ate book after book and page after page. I got poetry for breakfast and novels for tea and plays for my supper. No more poverty. Welcome, young poet. In here you are free to follow your star to where you should be. That door of the library was the door into me. And Locker and Shelley said, come to the feast, Whitechapel Library, Aldgate East.
And also there's more in-between spaces, Edgelands. There's a section of the exhibition called Beyond the City, which looks at what lies beyond the city walls, both literally and metaphorically, what gets occluded, what gets pushed to the edges. Traditionally, we might think about the suburbs as being somewhere fairly banal and safe, tedious even, but actually we're saying that beneath the surface in some of these more anonymous suburban areas, there's something slightly dystopic, something slightly more interesting going on.
Now, I'm going to have to out myself at this point as a bit of a fantasy geek, because I've seen posters for the exhibition around town, and in fact a friend of mine, similarly geeky, sent me a picture on her iPhone of the slogan, one of them which is "Not all those who wander are lost," and I happen to know that that's taken from Lord of the Rings, which of course is fantasy. It doesn't really have its groundings in a physical reality at all. So are we to take it then that you have included literature that has been sort of sparked off by landscape rather than just actually bedded down in it?
Yeah, we're looking at the ways that writers have been inspired by their own landscapes that they know, and in terms of Tolkien, the changing landscapes of his childhood, the development of industrialisation around his home, fed into The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. We're not saying that he's describing his childhood places accurately or recording them objectively, but clearly there was something going on that inspired him. And that's the case with a number of the exhibits, which look at the way that fantastic wild landscapes, which may have grown beyond all recognition from the original places that inspired them, nonetheless have their roots in real spaces and places of the British Isles. So it's trying to see writing about place as very much an imaginative exercise. It's not the same as a kind of objective mapping.
On that note, I think we'd better go and take a look around, have a look at some of the items that you have here. So, Tanya Cook, we're now standing at the first case at the beginning of the exhibition. Can you talk us through what we're looking at?
The first section is called Rural Dreams, and we've opened the section with a kind of a look at the way that legends have grown often out of the rural landscape. The very first item in the exhibition is a book called Polyolbion, which is a really long poetry book published in the 17th century by a man called Michael Drayton. And he actually made an attempt to kind of go around the whole of England and Wales describing the landscape, but also it's illustrated very beautifully with these engravings of kind of gods and goddesses of the rivers and the hills and these kind of ancient figures coming out of the landscape.
Is this the 1622 edition?
Yeah, we've got two different editions here so that we could have two different pages on show. So one page shows Yorkshire and the other one is the very beautiful frontispiece, which has got a kind of a Britannia figure on it. That is the very opening, looking at how stories come from the land, yeah. And that's the starting point.
And in the next case along, I can see a book of which I am very fond, Susan Cooper's Greenwich. This then are the books that you have spun out of the legends of the land, this kind of literature.
We decided to have a kind of a section about the figure of the Green Man, yeah. And how that is reused in literature. So we've actually got a Green Man sculpture from Alston Abbey in Leicestershire to show with these books. And then we've got things like Sir Gawain in the Green Knight, obviously a mysterious green figure, Robin Hood, who can be associated with this, and Greenwich, which is a kind of a feminist version of the myth. And the Green Man really is an ancient fertility symbol to do with the harvest, and again, stories that have come out of the landscape and that the landscape's very important to them.
So let's move on a bit further round now. We've got a section which appears to be called Earthly Paradise. Could you tell me a little bit about this?
Yeah, this is about the idea of the countryside as being this kind of very idyllic place that people can go to escape from the evils of the town, and how often this is not really the truth. So we start from the very first idea of talking about the countryside as this beautiful idyllic place, which is by Alexander Berkeley, and it's called The Eclogues, and it was published in approximately 1518. I don't think we know the exact date, it's not dated.
Because Virgil did the same thing, didn't he, back in Roman times?
This is exactly came from that tradition, ancient Greece and Rome, looking at the pastoral as being kind of beautiful shepherds cavorting and not really
and
any of the work.
Pressed linen and
very clean. So yeah, this is the kind of the myth and how it was presented. But then as we go through, you look at how some writers have kind of satirised it and sent it up. So we've got people like Posy Simmons, who wrote Tamara Drew in The Guardian.
We're very familiar with that one.
We've got some part of her proofs for that, we've borrowed. So showing that the countryside, you go to the countryside to get away from all of this turbulence, but it
bring
just
it all
be
with
there.
You. Yeah. And we're now, as the exhibition isn't completely built yet, we're now going into the strong room where some of the final exhibits are being kept to go and look at some of Faye Godwin's photographs.
Obviously, it's a text-based exhibition in that we're looking at writers and the way they've constructed landscapes. But we've got an example here of a visual text collaboration between the poet laureate Ted Hughes and the photographer Faye Godwin. And it was a real collaboration based around the Calder Valley, which is near where Hughes grew up and is also the ancient Celtic kingdom of Elmet. And so they collaborated on a book called Remains of Elmet, which explored this area for its post-industrial traces, the way that the industrialisation of the valley, which had overtaken the original kind of wild landscape, was in turn being reconquered by nature. And we can see here some photos, one of them called Lum Chimneys, which is of a chimney of a former mill now covered by bracken and plants, very much taking on an aspect of a tree. It looks from a distance as if it was, absolutely.
You see, Ted had said that he would like to write, but he needed the visual stimulus to write the poems. Ted contacted me again years later. Have you finished yet? And I said, well, actually, I'm ready to start all over again, because in the meantime, I'd done the Ridgeway, which, as far as I was concerned, cut my teeth on landscape work. So Ted went off with the early pictures and started writing poems. Poems came back to me, which triggered off new pictures for me. And in many cases, when we finally came to an end, which had some huge table and laid out all the pictures and poems, and quite a few of the choices of the pairings were his. I mean, some of the poems were quite difficult for me to understand, whereas none of my pictures were difficult for him to understand, so that he made very good pairings in many cases, you know, almost on an instinctive level.
Another section is called Beyond the City, where we're looking at the construction, the literary construction of the suburbs. The word suburb first appears in one of Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, in the tale of the Canon's Yeoman. The Canon's Yeoman's tale. And at that point, it describes a place on the edge of town full of danger, full of thieves. We think, of course, though, of the suburbs as being much more the 19th century construction of somewhere away from the hustle and bustle of the town. But what we're trying to show in this section is both that the suburbs are a dynamic force, which, as the city expands themselves, of course, expand into the countryside, but also a construction of the mind. And we've got a good example here by John Berger, now based in the Alps, but a London post-war writer. And in one of his more recent stories, in a book called Here Is Where We Meet, he has a story called Islington. So this is probably relevant to Guardian readers. Cut that bit out of you. The story Islington, looking at how Islington itself geographically has stayed in the same position, but in terms of how people think about it, Islington is all of a sudden a lot closer than it used to be. And you can see in the story, it says, for Londoners today, Islington is far closer than it used to be, because as it's gone up market, as house prices have risen, as the gentrification has taken place, all of a sudden a place that was originally seen as somewhat dangerous and far out has all of a sudden been accommodated by the centre and been drawn much closer into the kind of hegemonic centre. So the suburbs, and really what John Berger's doing there is just reflecting something that Edward Thomas, the poet, and Walker, and nature writer, was said 100 years earlier in the early 20th century. Edward Thomas wrote about the suburbs being ultimately unknowable, but essentially a construction of the mind. So not a clearly defined geographic area, but something that really depends on this kind of subjective impression. And moving back a couple of hundred years, we've got a really nice illustration here called The March of Bricks and Mortar, where you can see literally, although the subtitle is London Going Out of Town or The March of Bricks and Mortar, it's a George Cruikshank illustration. Literally the city, absolutely, it's literally the city, it's spades and bricks getting up and marching, going out to attack the countryside. So of course you've got the suburbs positioned uneasily between the rural and the urban, and as being something that are conquered by the onslaught of a city.
Fascinating to see the concerns that we still have today being first aired, you know, hundreds of years ago.
Absolutely, and that's one of the things that we definitely wanted to do with the exhibition, was to try and show how things that we talk about today in terms of space and place are absolutely nothing new. So, you know, fears of what lies beyond the city, as we said, date back to Chaucer. There's a good bit in the industrial section looking at the fear of railways, and you know, at the moment it's a very current topic with the debate around High Speed 2 and the impact that High Speed 2 will have. Well, that's nothing new. George Eliot was writing about it in Middlemarch. William Wordsworth was writing poems to protest against the arrival of the railways in the Lake District. So, you know, nothing new.
What are we looking at now?
So we think of Arthur Conan Doyle, author of Sherlock Holmes and so much more, as being the chronicler of the city.
Absolutely.
Sherlock Holmes and Watson living in Baker Street, fighting crime in the centre in those kind of narrow Victorian gaslit streets, which is all true, but we've put Conan Doyle in the suburbs on the grounds that he was a suburban man himself. We can see here an opening from the Strand magazine, which is where he did in fact publish a number of his Sherlock Holmes stories.
Day with Dr. Conan Doyle.
Yeah, day with. So it's an at-home piece in the Strand, basically, with Conan Doyle and a crazy wheel contraption, his wife dutifully beside him.
Is that? Is it a bike?
Well,
is
it's
a,
well, yeah, it's exactly. Is it a bird? No, it's kind of a halfway between a penny farthing and a pram, really, isn't it? Yeah, exactly. But it's Conan Doyle absolutely delighting in his suburban existence. He lived in Norwood, which at that time was very much resolutely suburban, removed from the dangers, both the moral and the physical dangers of London. And it was from Norwood, from these safe, suburban, family-orientated environments, that he was writing about the mysteries of Sherlock Holmes in the centre. And, of course, he wasn't just the author of Sherlock Holmes, although he's known for that. Primarily now, he was the author of historical fiction, and we can see here he was also the author of that short-lived genre, the suburban romance, which as readers migrated to the suburbs, of course, writers had to cater for this new readership, which was embraced by Conan Doyle enthusiastically, and the book we're showing here is called Beyond the City, the Idyll of the Suburbs, and it is as idyllic and uneventful and secure as Conan Doyle's own life in the suburbs was.
It's interesting you talking about Conan Doyle living in the suburbs and writing that gnarly, gritty detective fiction that's very much embedded in the city, because I was thinking about that when we saw Susan Cooper earlier on as well. I know that she wrote her Over Sea Under Stone books, which are absolutely inherently of the English landscape when she was living in Florida. So do you think there's something in this idea that often writers will write better of their landscape when they're away from it, when they can see it at a distance?
It's a really, really interesting question, and it comes down to this sense of authenticity. Do you have to know the area? Do you have to be immersed in it to write about it? I mean, a really good, there's two examples of that, one of which is Graham Swift's Waterland, and no one can quite believe Graham Swift when he says that he didn't really go to the Fens. He doesn't come from East Anglia. He didn't go there to live for a year in order to write Waterland. He's a South London man, and you can see that in some of his other novels. And he read a bit, he researched in the British Museum and the British Library, but he absolutely wasn't implicated in that background, and he feels it's not important because it's a creative act ultimately. But that can lead to a sense of betrayal. And there's another example in one of the items that we're showing, which is Richard Llewellyn, famous for as being the author of How Green Was My Valley. And when he died, there was a sense of real betrayal when it was realised that actually he didn't himself live in South Wales in a mining community. He wasn't actually Welsh. He was born in Hendon, brilliantly. But that's not to say that his depiction of South Wales mining life is any less authentic than a number of miners who themselves did write creative accounts of mining life in that area. So, no, I think absolutely you don't have to come from that area. And in many ways, having that distance allows you perhaps to take the measure of a place perhaps more effectively.
You mentioned Waterland, Graham Swift's novel. Let's go and have a look at the watery bit of the exhibition.
Paradoxes of this region is it can look rather inert, but there's more to it than meets the eye, and there is this elemental struggle going on all the time here. Realism, fatalism, phlegm. To live in the Fens is to receive strong doses of reality. The great flat monotony of reality, the wide empty space of reality. Melancholia and self-murder are not unknown in the Fens. Heavy drinking, madness, sudden acts of violence are not uncommon. How do you surmount reality, children? How do you acquire, in a flat country, the tonic of elevated feelings? If you are an Atkinson, it's not so difficult. If you could look down from your Norfolk uplands and see in these level Fens some idea, a drawing board for your plans, you can outwit reality.
So we're now looking at the Waterland section of the exhibition, and water is obviously hugely important when you're talking about the landscape of Great Britain, because we're surrounded by it and it runs through us, and anyone who's gone outside recently will know that there's plenty of it in the air as well. What are the highlights of this section, do you think?
I found this section really fun to work on, partly because I'm from the Bournemouth area, so it was like a kind of a homecoming for me. But we've got some great books about the seaside, like Graham Greene's Brighton Rock. We've got the part of Ulysses that's set in Sandymount Strand in Dublin, which is kind of the seaside area of Dublin. We've also got a section about rivers, and this kind of looks at the way that rivers are quite often used by authors as a kind of a life cycle, a symbol, I guess, the way that they're teeming with life, but also often authors use them as a kind of a drowning scene. So things like Our Mutual Friends of lots of famous drownings in that, and George Eliot's Mill on the Floss as well. But then also the idea of rivers is kind of this place from which life comes forth, and Dart by Alice Oswald is a really good example of that. And she, to prepare for it, interviewed people who lived and worked around Dart for quite a number of months and prepared this work that was kind of giving the river a voice of its own, as if the river was a living being.
Like a ship, the shape of flight, or like the weight that keeps it upright, or like a skyline crossed by breath, or like the planking bent beneath, or like a glint, or like a gust, or like the lofting of a mast. Such am I who flits and flows and seeks and serves and swiftly goes. The ship sets sail, the weight is thrown, the skyline shifts, the planks groan, the glint glides, the gust shivers, the mast sways, and so does water.
It also feeds back, doesn't it, into what we were talking about earlier, the idea of the pagan, religious aspects of the landscape in Britain, and the idea of river gods is a very old one, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, The Wind in the Willows is in this section, and I selected it to go in this section partly because obviously it's famous for being the great book of the river, but also, yeah, of course, messing about in boats, but also because it's got this kind of middle section which people often forget about, which is called the Piper at the Gates of Dawn, where the god Pan appears to mole and rat. Yeah, it's a total return to kind of a pagan Britain. So yeah, I feel like the exhibition's kind of circular because you get that legend in the land at the beginning and the Wind in the Willows right at the end.
Don't be silly, Emma. The water goes right in their front doors.
How do you know?
Well, as a matter of fact, we both know. Don't we, Alexandra?
The mole had been working very hard.
It's all to do with the river.
And a certain mole and rat and Mr. Badger.
Alexandra and Mr. Toad!
Must imagine what you can't see, and that there are voices to hear if only you let them speak.
That's right. You see, darlings, you must listen to the river. It's just the same as ever it was and as it always will be. Always changing and always the same.
Don't forget to start your free 14-day trial of audible.co.uk and to download your free audiobook. Head to guardian.co.uk/audible.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.